Land tax, stamp duty, tenants. Sure, property is great, but there are easier ways to get your passive income, sometimes with franking credits. Through ETFs or exchange-traded funds, you can buy a basket of shares in many different companies in one trade. BetaShares offers Australia's broadest range of ETFs, including income-focused funds, which aim to provide yield-hungry investors with attractive income streams. Discover the BetaShares range of ETFs and how simple they can be to invest in by going to betashares.com.au. Read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website and consider if the fund is right for you.
This is a podcast by the Rask Group. It's for educational purposes only. So please do not make a financial, legal, investment or taxation decision based on solely what you hear in this show.
Welcome to the Australian Property Podcast.
We're on a mission to be Australia's most trusted property podcast.
I'm Owen Rask, founder of the Rask Group.
I'm Pete Wargent, author and buyer's agent.
I'm Amy Linardi, and I am a buyer's agent.
I'm Chris Bates, ex-financial planner and mortgage broker.
Together, we'll take you through every step of your property journey.
From first home buyer to decades of property investing.
Chris Bates, welcome to this episode of the podcast, mate.
Owen, always good to chat, mate. How's life?
Life is pretty good. It's kind of transitioned to jumper weather in Melbourne. Recording this in late March, and I got to admit, there's been a bit of a chilly breeze come over Melbourne last week or so. And naturally, as I say that, everyone around Australia is right now thinking, "Why would you live in Melbourne?" Except the people in Tassie, of course, who are our brethren. But I'm all right, mate. I enjoy it. How are you going?
Mate, well, in about 40 minutes, I'm actually driving to Melbourne from the beaches up in Sydney. So 11-hour drive or whatever it is ahead of us. So I didn't know to bring a jumper. I thought it was actually going to be 30 degrees on the weekend. So it sounds like I've got to pack the jumper.
I think you're bringing it with you, mate. I think you're bringing it with you. So it's actually going to turn it on for you this Easter long weekend. So have fun while you're in Melbourne. Obviously today, mate, we're answering questions. You're a qualified mortgage broker, former financial advisor. We've partnered together to offer mortgage broking through the Flint Group via Rask, which is a wonderful thing. And so many people, hundreds of people have entered that process already since we began. So I will direct anyone to the show notes and the link there that says mortgage broking if you want to get in contact with Chris's team at Flint Group. We're going to be answering questions today. And as always, when it comes to answering questions, one of the beautiful things about all of our hosts at the Rask Group is that I myself am qualified to give general financial advice in Australia. Chris is a qualified mortgage broker and acts under a credit license. So you kind of can ask your questions no matter which channel you're coming through, and you'll get someone who's qualified to answer that question. But it's really important to understand that we don't know your personal circumstances. So that's why we ask for some funny names to keep it a bit lighthearted, but also to remind everyone that you should seek out a professional, like say Chris or a mortgage broker of your choosing, or a financial advisor if you need personalized financial advice or personalized mortgage broking services. With that said, Chris, there was one question, and I can't remember if I put it in today's show notes as I was going through it or not, but it did come through. So I apologize to anyone who did ask this question. And it was such a simple and elegant question that came through the Ask a Question link in your podcast player. It says, does landscaping improve the value of your house? Like, should you invest in that if you're planning to sell? Chris, thoughts?
I reckon it's one of the easiest things to do potentially and can add the most, you know, particularly if you give it a few years to really embed and really sort of grow. And I mean, we did a big landscaping job at our last place. I definitely overcapitalized on that. I think I stupidly went for, I'll pay for the materials and I'll pay for the labor as they build it, and then kept on adding more and more things to it. But I actually went back to look at that. We still own that property. Went back and looked at it last week or the week before. And, you know, I hadn't been there for 12 months. And the landscaping is going berserk. And so, you know, and it's becoming a proper jungle out there. And all the plants are, you know, added a meter to them. And I do think it's like an amazing feeling out in the backyard right now compared to what it was initially, like a good for goats, but not good for anyone else. And so, at our new house as well, I did some landscaping to it. I just, you know, some very simple things, cutting back trees, you know, made a bigger grass area, you know, and I think the small changes actually didn't cost that much, but it completely transformed our backyard. And so I think what happens when people do builds, they run out of money and then they put the landscaping at the end and they just throw some cheap plants in. I think it's a big opportunity miss not thinking about the landscaping as part of the overall build and just making sure that you know, allocate enough money there to it. And so, yeah, I think it's a huge value add. You know, something with really beautiful established gardens, you know, that whole first impressions when you get there, that street appeal, the how nice it is to live in, you know, in the backyard. And, you know, I think, I personally put a lot of value on that. And I'm pretty sure a lot of buyers would when they, maybe you've got to be a bit careful though around how much maintenance it is as well. Like there is a lot of buyers that want something pretty low maintenance. You just got to be careful what you put in. So a lot of people think, oh God, that's a lot of work to maintain that. That may decrease the value, but something that's low maintenance but looks amazing. Yeah, I think it's a good idea.
Mm. I always look for those kind of easy wins. And we had obviously Amy Lenardi on the Australian Property Podcast took us through her, I think it was a 25 grand renovation and walked us through that a few months ago back on the Australian Property Podcast. So go and check that out, folks, if you're interested. I did actually, in anticipation for this question, I did look at some research this morning and there was some research, and I'll quote the Open Agent website, which says, according to landscape economist, didn't know it was such a thing, John Harris, good landscaping can add up to 28% of a home's overall value. And according to a research paper by Clemson University professor Mark Henry, even taking your landscaping and gardening efforts from good to excellent could add significant value to your home, around 6-7%. So at the lower end of the range versus the higher end of the range, if you go conservative, it's probably an easy way for a lot of folks to add value, even if you're planning on letting out that place, if you're renting it out. Sounds like a good way to try and add value beyond just a lick of paint, which a lot of people commonly jump to. So we did get a few questions come through. And again, you can send that in via the link in your show notes. So there was a question which I'll just broadly summarize from Sandy Pad, who said, are there any incentives or initiatives to build a second dwelling on your property in New South Wales? They refer to granny flats as one of the things that's taken their notice. And I think that this is a really topical thing at the moment, Chris, because obviously we are, just like everyone else, concerned about, you know, people having roofs over their heads. And one of the, well, there's been many proposals, let's be honest, and you and Pete talk about this every week. Some of them are just completely farcical. But one of the initiatives that seems to be coming to the fore across the country, I'm recording this from Victoria, and I know this is a huge focus at the moment, is the ability to add granny flats without a planning permit, but with a building permit. What do you think of this as someone who has invested in property and advises clients across the board? What do you think about this?
Look, I do get a little bit nervous when people are adding granny flats and second dwellings to their property. It can sound great at first, right? I'm going to get a bit of extra income from this granny flat. But then as soon as you start renting that property out, there's potentially an impact to your capital gains tax exemption on your home.
Good point.
Now, if you live in that property for the next 20, 30 years and you're okay with the lifestyle impact of someone renting the granny flat on your property, you know, sometimes it's on top of your garage at the back of the property and you never really see them, right? And so the lifestyle impact's really minimal. Sometimes it's quite big because they've got to use your driveway, right? And you know, your privacy's sort of affected, et cetera. So just be really careful, I guess, around that. Because the final thing is if you do decide to change your plan. Like you said, I'm building this granny flat because it's going to give me a bit of extra income to help with the mortgage. Then I have to pay tax on that. Then it just affects my CGT. How much are you actually making on this? But when you sell a property, your buyers that would look to buy it would change, right? Because some buyers just want that backyard. They want that grass. You know, they want to put a pool in. They don't want to have the privacy issue. And so what ends up happening is you can actually devalue your asset by having a granny flat, because some people say, well, actually, I don't want to buy that because I don't want the granny flat. Then I've got to knock it down. And so the house next door, which is an older house with the backyard without the granny flat, could actually be worth more than the house with the granny flat. And so just be really careful you don't devalue your asset with a granny flat. You know, when you're buying an investment property, it's the same principles. A lot of people say, well, I want the higher rental income. Okay, well, that's great. If you hold that property for the next 20, 30 years, and that's great because you own all the land and yes, you've got more rental income, that's great. But if your life plan changes and you end up selling that investment property and you build a granny flat, well, there's no guarantees that you'll get that back dollar for dollar, and it's no guarantees that it'll add a lot of value to the property. And so just be really careful around granny flats. I think ultimately, from a social point of view, more roofs and more bedrooms and we definitely need. And so I think that's great to be providing, you know, if you've got spare land, to be providing more accommodation for people. I think that's a great thing. But just on your personal situation, financially, is it a good move? Often I would say no. I would say that you're devaluing your asset more than what you've just spent on the granny flat, and to be really careful.
That's a good point. It's probably the counterpoint to what I was thinking, to be honest, because our place, as you know, is a 3-bedroom place, and we do have a bit of land front and back that we can build on. And I actually saw the granny flat opportunity as something where maybe it could, pardon me, double as a quote unquote office for me, or an extra bedroom or something like that, where we can maybe move some stuff out of the smaller house as we plan for a family and those types of things. Or if someone is, you know, does have older kids or something like that, it can help them stay semi, I guess, detached from your house, but also minimize costs for them while they save up a deposit to buy a house or these types of things, which, you know, it will vary by your block, by your goals, as Chris said. But it's interesting because I know this is very, very eagerly awaited here in Victoria, because let's be honest, it's not just Victorians, but across the country, it's quite bureaucratic just to build something that is reasonable from a licensed builder anyway. So, Chris, there was another question, which I might jump to the end. And it was a question that came through. It's from a property investor. It came through on the Australian Property Podcast channel, but it's relevant to everyone at RASC. It's from Liam. Liam says, I'm 26 from Perth and have two apartments, one in Scarborough and one in the city. Both done very good in the market, up $300,000 in value together. Well done, Liam. And he says that he was talking to some friends and he was thinking about making a third investment, but he's been scared off by interest rates. So his question is, for those that are scared by interest rates, should they be more scared when interest rates drop and the possibility of house prices going up, with people thinking they can now afford a property and it ends up costing them more? What do you think? Like, how do you factor this in as someone who is either an investor or a buyer? Like, is higher interest rates bad? Are higher interest rates good for buyers? Like, how does this work in your mind?
Look, I do think you've got to be a bit careful with higher interest rates staying higher for longer. Interest rates, the cost of capital for debt will play a big part into sentiment, right? And so if interest rates stay at where they are now and they stay there for a few years, a lot of the growth that we've seen in the last 12 months might have to actually go back, right? Because what people are already betting on, and that's what's causing the market to go back up, is that people don't expect rates to stay high for long. And so that's already been, that I would say all the way back to 2023, at the start when there was a bit of momentum in the market and trying to go back in the years. You know, a lot of that was people were expectations that inflation is going to get under control. I'm actually going to take this as an opportunity to get in while everyone else is a bit scared about interest rates, because my belief is that at some point inflation is going to get under control and rate cuts are going to happen. Absolutely, that's behind some of the sentiment right now. So I think the issue is that if rates go high and you then have to sell your assets because you can't afford your cash flow and you haven't got buffers, etc. But I also think it's a good time to be buying when rates are high and not low, because that is a headwind at the moment that can turn into a tailwind, right? So for example, a client bought a property this week. They had a little house in Sydney. They've upgraded into a bigger house in the inner west of Sydney. You know, financially, they're doing, you know, quite well from an income point of view. And they've got this luxury of what? Do we keep our current house as an investment property and sell it in a few years' time, or do we sell it now? You know, they go in the short term, oh, cash flow is going to be really tight. I've got to pay higher interest rates on all this debt. But then on the plus side, that if rate cuts do come and borrowing capacity goes back up, then that becomes a bit of a tailwind for the property market, because if people can borrow more money and people have got more appetite to borrow because it's cheaper, then it leads to price increases. And so I'd say if you are looking to invest under higher interest rates, just got to be careful that you can afford the cash flow under the current interest rate. Plus, if rates go up, plus interest only, end terms on your current investment properties, making sure you don't get to a position where you've over leveraged and then you have to start paying principal and interest on all your loans as well. But ultimately, investing when rates are high and borrowing capacity is tight is actually a good time to invest if rates end up going back down. And I think that's why you can see investor numbers have gone up quite dramatically over the last 12 months. You know, the amount of investors out there is a lot more than it was because people are playing on that and they're actually saying, I think it's a good opportunity. In saying that though, there's a lot of investors actually leaving the market. There's a lot of research showing that investors who are stretched financially or haven't got great assets are selling their investment properties because the mortgages and the cash flow cost is negative and they just can't afford justify holding it. They're selling their investment properties and keeping their home. And so, yeah, hopefully that answers the question. Like, are rates good or bad? It really depends on where rates go and your personal situation around your cash flow, whether it's, you know, something a good decision or not.
Yeah. So imagine you get a lot of folks like, say, Liam, that come to you and think about borrowing again and again and again. Would it be fair to say that you, as a general rule, this obviously wouldn't apply to all of your clients or even just investors in general, it's just your opinion. Would it be fair to say that you favor like fewer assets that are higher quality and over, say, the bigger property portfolios that some people in the news seem to get headlines for?
Oh, absolutely. Look, if I go back and think through all the clients we've seen over the last decade in the property space, you know, even longer than that, to be honest, all the way back to 2012 is where my clients shifted from working with older clients to younger clients. The people that have done the best are the ones usually with the fewest number of quality assets that have held on, and usually in the housing market and usually in our capital cities. And so, and you can just look at the numbers, right? Look at the performance and the capital growth of those properties. Generally speaking, they're in areas that gentrify over time. So at the moment, maybe a lot of the wealth isn't going there. A lot of the high incomes aren't going there, but it's slowly, you know, they were buying a little bit closer to the city. And then as the city and prices go up, they start moving to these suburbs. That sort of ripple effect is absolutely where most of the growth comes, is because of the incomes in those areas really shift. The people who have gone down that quantity strategy, they might have done all right out of one or two just because they've held it for a long period of time. And maybe it's a house in the Gold Coast or something like that. But they're usually that the growth on that has been subdued because they've made one or two or three bad investment decisions. They've gone for something where it hasn't gone up for 10 years. They bought an apartment. They've, you know, maybe gone for something with a high cash flow or maintenance has really hit them, et cetera. And so usually those people with the bigger portfolios, I would say, have stuffed it up more than they've got it right. And if they have got one or two right, it's usually their home or one investment property into the housing market that's done really well for them. And they've just held it for a long period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that people can build up the meaningful amount of equity in apartments it's over such a short period of time too. And it makes me think, like, since I've known you, I basically thought to myself that it would be, and we even talked about this personally yesterday morning, you and I would prefer to have fewer properties than you know, go down that multiples approach because it just makes my life easier as well. So I think one of the takeaways for Liam and for anyone else in this situation is just to think, what's going to help me sleep easy at night? And are there other things in my life that I can pursue and not just go down this, just add more properties? Maybe it's consolidation. Maybe it's a look at other things. Maybe it's starting your own business. Maybe it's, you know, maybe there are other things you can do to get ahead financially and achieve your long-term goals. So that's a really good one. We had a question, and this is one of those really awkward ones where it's kind of like halfway between mortgage broking question, halfway between financial advice question, halfway between, you know, tax question, because all the literature comes from the ATO on this one. But Don't Macquarie Be Happy writes in and says, oh, sorry, not Don't Macquarie. We'll go to the next question. Sorry. This one was about the first home super saver scheme. Actually, it was from Don't Macquarie Be Happy, and basically said, I'm seeing all over social media feeds at the moment, small trendy finance pages, as opposed to the global conglomerate that is Rask Media, posting about how young Australians should be piling their savings into the First Home Super Saver Scheme, commonly called FHSSS, for those of you that like acronyms, as the tax benefit is basically a free 17.5%, they say. For those of us saving for a first home, would you suggest these government schemes as a worthy quote-unquote investment, or are there potential benefits to employing these funds elsewhere in the medium term in, say, a balanced portfolio? Now, I'm going to ask this question in a different way, but it is a very important question that a lot of our first home buyers in the RAS community are asking, Chris, and I know you deal with a lot of first home buyers. Do you see many of them using the First Home Super Saver scheme? And is there anything that people should be mindful of?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, jump onto the ATO website, type in that FSSH, and just look at the eligibility of it and look at the conditions, right? And I think where I can see it goes wrong is that people end up not buying a property. And they have to pull the money out, and all the rules around getting the money out, where your super is, and just be really clear on, you know, how that would play out and the sequence, and the process you need to get to. Ultimately, though, if you can put a bit of money in there, the whole reason for that scheme is to, you know, give first home buyers a bigger deposit, right, and save them a bit of tax in doing so. And so I'd just be really understand exactly how it works in terms of, you know, the deeming rate on the investment, how to get your money out, what's the process, do you need to live in the property, all those sort of things before you put your money into super. But ultimately, I think it's a good little scheme, and it's been around for quite a few years now. I was trying to remember when it actually came out. It was probably like 3 or 4 years since it's been out. Some people have brought us, you know, I think you have up to 50,000 in there, up to a maximum you can have in there, which, that's over a couple, can be quite a lot of tax savings that you've built up. And when it first came out, I was a little bit like, thanks, you're not really solving the, you know, housing affordability crisis. And I don't really like the whole mentality behind mixing super with homes. Like, yeah, give us a tax break, but don't have to put it into our super fund and then withdraw it. It's kind of like a legacy issue because the government didn't know how else to do it. And rather than just giving a rebate to your tax or something like that, like it's a very convoluted system, like trying to mix super and personal investing for a house deposit. I do think it's one of the things, though, they're trying to get people more comfortable with using super for housing. And I do see in the future that changing. I just think it's more of a when thing, you know, when the right government gets in power. I can easily see them saying, hey, you now use your super for a housing deposit. There's just going to be things that they're going to do in the future to perpetuate the property bondy, basically, things like extending loan terms. And I can absolutely see that, you know, in the future, first home buyers will be able to access their super for housing deposits. Whether that's a good thing or not, there's a whole other discussion. But this was sort of a little bit of an eye-opening that, you know, mixing super and housing is already happening.
Yeah, interesting. I think Cameron came on the show recently, Cameron Murray, and spoke with Pete a little bit about these types of things. And I think another Cameron Kusher, I believe, was talking about this on Twitter the other day. I don't want to get you stuck in like a political question here, Chris, but just generally speaking, you foresee that maybe in the future people would have easier access to super to get that first deposit.
Yeah, and I don't really agree with it, to be honest, because ultimately you're just going to perpetuate the housing affordability. You know, if you give people more access to money for a deposit, and then you potentially that money's just going to go straight into it. And it's going to, those people buying right now, but then all you're going to do is create further inflation in terms of prices, right, and further growth. And then the next generation is going to find it even harder to get in. And so anything that stimulates demand without solving a lot of the other underlying issues in the property market around supply usually just very quickly gets factored into prices. It was very similar to when just last year, New South Wales government allowed no stamp duty up to 1.5 million. Everyone, first-time buyers were like, this is amazing. You know, I don't have to pay stamp duty. But very quickly, the money that you saved in stamp duty went straight in terms of pushing up house prices. So people were buying $1.4 million places at $1.5 million, and they were, and this absolutely was happening. And yes, they were saving $70,000 in stamp duty, but they actually just paid $100,000 more for the house. And then the people in the next, you know, trying to buy after that, and now have to buy it after 1.5 as well. But ultimately, you know, governments get in power by winning votes, and, you know, the first-time buyers at that point in time will see it as a real big win for them, and then they'll vote and they'll get in power, and then, you know, a few years down the line, we go, oh, was that really such a good idea that everyone put all their super into housing? And ultimately, if that money stayed in super and then compounded over the next 20, 30, 40 years for them, that's going to have a huge amount less in their superannuation if they take out $50,000 for a housing deposit. And so that's another thing that will happen in the future where, yeah, they've got a house, but their super is nowhere near what it could have been if they didn't have to use that money.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's always been an interesting one because solving the supply side, the how many houses there are available to buy, is so much more difficult than just handing out money for a particular segment of the population who want to buy a house. Seems like you're the good guy when you do that. And so, well, on the supply side, when you try and solve those problems, seems like you're the bad guy because you're forcing houses down, or, you know, you're giving incentives to builders or whatever the case might be politically. It's so hard to solve that side of the equation. There was a question which came through from No Likely Tax. I'm going to generalize this one because it gets into the murky waters of a tax strategy that could convolute this conversation really quickly. What you and I spoke recently is one of the most popular episodes we've done this year across most podcasts, to be honest with you, Chris. So kudos to you, brother. And it was about equity release. Now, we made a distinction, or I should say you made a distinction between equity release and debt recycling. Can you explain, maybe just as a quick question on this, like, can you just explain how you define the two?
So, equity release is basically when you go to a bank, they do a valuation on your property, and you say to them, oh, I've got a $1 million property and I've got a $500,000 loan. They would do a valuation on the property, comes in $1 million. And generally, banks would lend up to 80% on the value of that property without really any questions asked. I mean, that does change in times where they get a little bit more restrictive on releasing equity, but often is the case where they'll release up to 80%. And so your $500,000 loan could increase to 80% on $1,800,000 really simply. And that money would just sit in an offset account. Wouldn't cost you anything because that $300,000 they give you would just go into an offset account. So that's something called equity release, right? And usually you can do that up to 80%. Sometimes you can go even higher that if you played a Lamy at the bank, et cetera. Now, when you actually call debt recycling, that's a whole other, it's when you use that money to then go buy an investment, right? So maybe that investment is ideally share, something that goes up in value, so maybe it's shares or property, et cetera. And then the whole idea between debt recycling is actually when you then sell those assets that you buy, the profit you make on that, then you pay off your home loan and then re-borrow again after that to then go buy more investments. And so you're kind of washing your debt and you're releasing equity, you're buying investments, then you're selling the investments to then pay off your home loan to then release equity, then to buy more investments. So that's that recycling element. Firstly, I don't like it. I would say that if you are going to go and release equity to go and buy investments and hold the investments rather than paying stamp duty, selling costs, capital gains tax, trying to time markets, having to re-enter the markets. Like, it just, to me, it's making it way too complex. And, you know, yes, sometimes there's a situation when you can buy investments and they go up a lot in value, and then it makes sense to sell those investments to then pay off your home because home debt's more expensive than investment debt. And there is like an arbitrage there potentially. But I don't like the philosophy around buying investments short term to then resell them to pay off home to then rebuy investments. I think that's just, you know, best investing is long term. And so whether that's shares or property, that recycling element shouldn't really be a big part of it. Maybe you do it once or twice over time, but you don't do it on a regular basis. It seems quite risky.
Interesting. Yeah, that was where I think this conversation, I took it to X or took it over to Twitter after we released that podcast last time. So it's available in your podcast feeds if you're interested. It's the equity release question. It was something, the title was something to the effect of, should Owen redraw or upgrade to a farm or something. We talked about, and Chris, being my mortgage broker, Chris and I riffed on that for about an hour and how to do it and so on and so forth. But I think a lot of people took that to mean that I would be a fan of debt recycling, and it's not necessarily the case. I'm just thinking of how do I strategically use equity in my home for long-term investing. And it definitely does not suit everyone. As Chris said, it does increase the size of your mortgage. So that's definitely not for everyone. Some people have different priorities, right? So that's really important to understand too. I was going to ask you a general question. Seeing that we do these property Q&As once a month, I thought maybe I'd just get a pulse check on you. Just one question from me.
is probably the most important question for people, which is, like, how do you think about where interest rates might go between now and, say, the end of the year? I know this is a high-level question, but obviously you're going to get this a lot from every single day from your mortgage broking clients who are thinking, well, Chris, should I lock in or should I stay variable? Should I do a bit of both? Like, how are you seeing that right now as we sit here and record in late March 2024?
Look, I think everyone's been taught lessons around, you know, trying to predict where interest rates would go. I mean, if I fly all the way back to 2008, when rates went to zero, I was working in the UK as a financial advisor. And, you know, if someone said to me that would have been still zero, you know, 10, 12, 15 years later, I would have said no, right? Even 5 years later. And so, you know, that whole period there, everyone was surprised that rates were just kept dropping and rates were stuck on zero. And, you know, we had negative rates. And, you know, that was a whole conversation whether that's even going to happen in Australia. And so I think, you know, you've got to have sort of this long-term thing that it's very hard to predict where rates are going. And then I think in the last 2 or 3 years, we've completely underestimated the rate where rates are going, right? You know, and the forecast on where the top of interest rates, it was going to be going to 2%, it's going to get 3%, 4%, et cetera. I think at the moment, look, you know, I do think all the signs are pointing that maybe the inflation genie is getting back in the bottle, but it's not as simple as it seems, and potentially rates are going to stay higher than what people expected for longer. But ultimately, it's heading in the right direction. And, you know, countries around the world where inflation is well within the band. Maybe in Australia, it's not as likely in the short term.
Yeah.
But that's changing so fast, right? Like, so I would say that the consumer is already, and this is what really matters, right? What is the buyer out there right now believe? Because that's getting factored into prices. And I would say the average buyer on the street right now starting to believe that rates aren't going up anymore and that rate cuts are coming at some point this year. I don't think they're out there thinking the rate's going to get cut from 4% down to 1%. You know, I do think they think maybe it's, you know, going to get dropped maybe 1% to 2% over the next few years. And that's probably the more aggressive ones. You know, the more conservative ones are probably thinking that rates are going to likely stay where they are or drop a little bit.
Yeah.
But ultimately, that's what's getting factored into prices right now. Now, if rates do stay higher for longer, and I think that'll really slow down the market. So if the interest rate expectations were that rates are going to stay where they are, if not go up, I do think that would take a lot of heat out of the market. People would say, look, I actually want to see how that plays out. And that happened at the tail end of last year as well. We had that extra rate increase. That did take a bit of steam out of the market. But then by the time February came around, the interest rate expectations were that the cuts were coming in 2024. And then that's probably been pushed out a little bit again in the last month or so, you know, because unemployment rates come back down and a few other things, right? And so, yeah, I think ultimately, I think the buyer on the street, though, is thinking that interest rates are hitting the top. And it's good to enter while interest rates are at the top, not the bottom. And they're already sort of banking the interest rate cuts are coming. The thing is, a lot of people entering the market right now, borrowing capacity is so tight, and they're getting assessment, the amount they can borrow is with an assessment buffer of 3%. And so they're only borrowing four and a half times their income. And so a lot of the people out there taking mortgages on right now are, you know, taking on mortgages that are, you know, historically really low compared to what they could have borrowed a few years ago. And so they're very affordable mortgages under higher rates. And even if rates stay high for the next few years, like the people who are really struggling, the people who took on a lot of debt in 2020, 2021, when you could borrow seven and a half times your income. And they thought that rates were going to stay at 2% and they didn't factor them going to 6%.
Yeah.
Those current buyers entering right now are going, well, I know your rates are 6% and I can only borrow four times my income. And so I'm not leveraging up like those a few years ago.
Do you remember, I think it was last month on this property Q&A, I told you that I'd been recently looking at some houses down on the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria. I think I told you that last month.
Yeah.
So we looked at 7 or 8 houses that day. We checked, that was about 6 weeks ago now at the time of recording. We checked recently, all of them are still available and 3 of them had cut their prices. And I think a big reason for that is it's kind of in that next tier. It's obviously Mornington Peninsula, which is not in that inner ring city kind of thing. A lot of holiday houses and that type of thing down there. And what just hearing from the real estate agents, it's clear that the sellers or the vendors are concerned that interest rates may even just stay where they are, and that's enough to cause them a bit of grief. So
I got some sort of boots on the ground, like anecdotally. It's just in one, or there's like three or four suburbs there, but I can see people. This is the number one question that's on everyone's mind. And you referenced something there at the beginning of the year, which was the US Federal Reserve chairman came out and basically spooked everyone into thinking that maybe rates wouldn't go down as everyone was expecting. Maybe they'd just stay flat, which kind of sent a ripple through everyone. And I imagine these people that are trying to sell these houses to folks like me, they were thinking, well, I thought they were going to go down, but now it might be stable for longer than I expected. So I guess one of the takeaways there is, if you're a property owner, is just to focus on those good savings habits, try and keep the costs down, try and manage your debt and not get into that situation in the future. And I thought that was really interesting. So maybe the next time we do this, Chris, I'll have another update for you and I'll be able to keep tracking those properties. But in the meantime, people can get in contact with you and the team by heading to the link in the show notes. It says Mortgage Broking. I'd highly encourage you to go and check out what the team at Flint Group can do. And if you do want to ask us a question, you can hit the link that's right next to that one, actually, and it says ask a question. Select either the Australian Property Podcast, Finance Podcast, or Investors Podcast, really any of them. And every month, Chris and I will be back to answer your property questions. We particularly like questions that do relate specifically to property and to lending and to cash flow and these types of things when Chris comes on the show. So please keep sending them in. We get hundreds maybe a week now, and I just love it. So keep sending them in. Leave us a review on iTunes if you're new to it and you like the show. We'd really appreciate that. But Chris, mate, it's always a pleasure to chat to you. So thanks for joining me.
Absolutely. And just to, you know, throw a point in there, which you probably didn't have time for, on the Mornington Peninsula, like I think what it really shows is there's different parts of the country all grow at different rates and have got different challenges. You know, the Mornington Peninsula right now has got a challenge with the changes with land tax. There's a lot of second homes down there that are really encouraging people to sell because the land tax is astronomical. A lot of people are getting, who've got those second homes, are getting burnt on their current home. So the mortgage is really smashing them on their home, and they've leveraged up and they bought a holiday house. And so their cash flow is getting really smashed. Plus the land tax has come in there. You've also found in that area, there's a lot of people leveraged up in the last 2 or 3 years because people were moving down there because of COVID. And so there's a lot more turnover than historical. And so that and then also this return to work, you know, people coming closer to the city, that Melbourne's getting its mojo back. Do I really want to live down the coast if I've got to commute 3 or 4 days? And so people are probably hugging the city more than they were two years ago. But in Sydney, you know, somewhere like Central Coast and Wollongong, that's back on the conversations again for quite a few of our clients.
Interesting.
Where people are pushed out of the inner city and the locations they want to live around the city. And they're going, well, I know return to work 3 days or 2 days. I'm just going to have to deal with the commute because home ownership really matters to me. And where I can afford is north of Wollongong or Central Coast or Newcastle. And they're having to make those compromises. And so, yeah, I think when you are looking at the market, you know, what's happening in your local area, what's happening to the properties you own, that's what you really want to know rather than the mass media news, because every market's got different supply and demand imbalances. So, yeah, look forward to having a chat. Yeah.
I think that's so important, Chris. And I didn't mean to, suggest that this may be indicative of the rest of the country, but definitely I see this as my opportunity. Right?
Absolutely.
This is because I'm getting to know the area, I see it as an opportunity for me and for our family to make that move now while we can, because ordinarily we might not be able to afford that area. So, you know, this is kind of the bittersweetness of it, is that maybe someone else's loss is my gain in this instance. And that's about being patient. You know, markets do change, and there's markets within markets, even different streets within suburbs. So use that to your advantage as you go out and you look for homes. Or investments that you're stalking. So, mate, this has been heaps of fun. We'll be back next month to answer questions. As always, Chris Bates from Flint Group. Absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Alan. Talk soon.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for tuning in to the Australian Property Podcast.
If you love the show, why not subscribe or leave us a review on Apple or Spotify?
And if you want to work with me, Amy, Pete, or Chris,
you'll find links in your podcast player to get in contact with us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Australian Property Podcast. We're huge advocates of getting the right advice at the right time from the right people. That's why it's important to understand that this podcast episode contained general financial information only. It is not designed to be specific or personalized to your financial, tax, or legal situation. With property, the check sizes are pretty big, so it's important you get advice from a licensed and trusted professional before acting on the information you hear in RASC podcasts. Thanks again for listening.
For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called RASC Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. RASC Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. RASC Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the RASC Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.